had a few announcements before we begin. I thought more people were going to be gone this week because of different things that are not. So we're going to have class Tuesday and Wednesday. So if you're interested, show up. If not, well, that's your problem. So we'll have that. And I noticed, I couldn't help but notice that the other night after I told everybody to ask Laura how much worse I was when I was younger, nobody asked her. I just couldn't believe it. So, but at any rate, let's make sure you're in fellowship here now, and we will continue on. Wrapping up this verse here, 33, oh, the depth of the riches, the abundance, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments, His decisions, His processes, and His ways, His policies, and all of that. Cannot be tracked unless He chooses, again, unless He reveals it. It's always a matter of possible revelation. But if He doesn't reveal it, you're not going to know. Well, we left off here in verse point 33 here in this context in Romans. Paul is focusing specifically on the plan of God as it relates to the salvation of the Gentiles. Again, as groups and the subsequent salvation of the Jews. Not specifically individuals. But we know individuals are involved. But that's not what he's focusing on. So 34, although Paul continues to experience significant and ongoing sorrow over the spiritual condition of his people, he recognized that God's eternal plan has taken all these things into consideration and is still advancing to its preordained conclusion. And so Paul manifests what we talked about in the first session, and that was you can have these very conflicting sort of emotions of great joy alongside great sorrow. And both are true. Both can exist simultaneously. Obviously, most of us, and I think most normal people, would rather have the great joy. I mean, if you have a choice. But the fact is, we don't always get that choice. The choices sometimes are made for us. When it comes to people who separate from you and peel off a doctrine, well, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. You just have to kind of acquiesce and orient to it. Well, 35, Paul concludes verse 33 with another exclamation that deals with the judgments of God and the ways in which God operates. 36, the first term, krema, is one that can refer generally to one's decisions or determinations. However, it is often used in a forensic sense. That's the Latin word for open court, means a legal setting, in the sense of a decision or judgment rendered by a judge. And 37, the fact that it is most often used in a legal setting would then focus on the punitive judgments that a judge passes on those that are being judged. In the context of these three chapters, several judgments have been referenced already. For instance, in Romans 9:18, so then he has mercy on whom he desires, and the hardening is viewed as, again, a judicial act by which God judges those he desires to judge. Now, again, we know this is not arbitrary. It's not done apart from volition. We understand all that. What if God, verse 22, although willing to demonstrate his wrath, part of God's revelation is revealing the fact that he's holy, that he's righteous, and that he hates sin, that sin is an affront to God at every level. Doesn't matter what kind of sin it is. All sin, he hates it all equally. Righteousness and sin cannot coexist. And he wanted to make his power known. He endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction. Again, doesn't point out how they were prepared, who all prepared them. It just says they are prepared. Then in chapter 11, we've seen several times he's referenced judgments 7 through 10. What then Israel is seeking, it has not obtained. But those who were chosen obtained it, the rest were hardened. That's a judgment. And then the judgment's detailed down through verse 10. And then in verses 20 through 22, quite right, they were broken off for their unbelief. That's a judgment. But you stand by your faith. If God did not spare the natural branches, he judged the Jews and removed them from their position of stewardship and all of that. And then you can see verses 25 also and 32. Well, 38, however, given the parallel term ways that follows, it is probably to be understood in the most broad sense of determinations of any kind. Which, of course, now that does include his punitive judgments. They would fall under the broader umbrella of just God's judgments or determinations. What God determines he's going to do. And that, of course, part of that is judging in a sense of a bad judgment. So 39 here, Paul states that God's decision making is unsearchable, which is the translation of the Greek adjective anexeronetos, which is derived from the verb exeronao, and a prefix that negates it. That entire point 40 family of words is rarely used, but the verb means to engage in a careful and minute search, to search out diligently or intently. It's used in 1 Peter to describe the functions of the Old Testament prophets as they were seeking to fully understand where God's plan was going. They saw in the terms of the Messiah and the prophecies that respected him, they saw two distinct things, glory and suffering. And they couldn't reconcile these two things necessarily even in one person. And certainly couldn't reconcile them temporally as occurring at the same time. But what they didn't see, of course, what they didn't know is that the glory aspect, the suffering aspect, came first. And that deals with the issues of the first advent. The glory aspects come much later. And so they didn't see, what they couldn't see was this gap of time that separated these two things. And that gap of time is the church age, essentially. It's slightly longer than that because you got the 7 years of Daniel's 70th week at the end of it. But just substantially, it's the church age. And that's what they couldn't see. And really, one of the things is if you, in verse 10, he talks about that. As to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful searches and diligent inquiries. And that's the, you got actually two strengthened forms. Exeteo is the first one. Exeteo means to seek or to look for something. Ek intensifies it. And it means to look hard, to be more diligent, to scour for something. And then you have it compounded with this word, the exeronao word. So they're not used much, but what it does say is that these prophets used everything at their disposal. And they were diligent students of the Word of God. They didn't just sit back and say, well, we don't understand this, so let's not worry about it. No, they wanted to understand it. And you see that, say, when you study the book of Daniel. You look at Daniel and the way he approaches God about revelation, you could tell Daniel wanted to learn. Daniel was fascinated, particularly with this character, the Antichrist. He was fascinated by this guy. And Daniel got more revelation on this guy than anywhere else, really. All the other revelation in the New Testament is pales compared to what Daniel found out. But again, it all works together. It's not as though we don't need them both. So, and as to this salvation, again, they made careful searches and diligent inquiries would even be a better way of translating it. And then in verse 11... and this is where it's badly translated. They've completely missed what's going on in the Greek here. It's seeking to know what time or what kind of time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. And that time factor is the church age that they couldn't figure out. And it was, again, if there's no revelation on it, I don't care how diligent you are. You can say, I got 50 years of doctrine. I can figure anything out. No, you can't. Not unless God reveals it, you cannot. And so these guys, and they were diligent students. It's not like they were slackers. They really wanted to know. And yet, God didn't reveal it. He's funny that way. Well, 41, the adjective in verse 33 denotes that which cannot be searched out. That which is unfathomable or impossible to discover. And 42, in a parallel statement, the final portion of verse 33 indicates that his ways are incapable of being tracked. And he uses, again, this idea, the metaphor, the picture, is of a path, one that one trods regularly. Where one walks, and by virtue of that, he's beaten down a path, and that becomes a way, or road, or a path. Well, the Greek noun hados, that should be hados, It's not hasas. I got the wrong character in there. That's hadas. A way, a road, or a path is used literally of the place on which one moves from one place to another. Or it is used of the action of traveling, a trip or journey. And 44, it is used metaphorically to denote the course of life, the way in which one behaves himself, his way of life or his conduct, his norms and standards, the way he operates. We talk about it modus operandi and modus vivendi, which just means your method of operation, how you conduct yourself, and modus vivendi, your manner of life, how you live. And there's a certain lifestyle that's supposed to be, that's obviously enjoined on God's people. We're going to see much of the practical stuff. We've dealt, really, the first 11 chapters of Romans have dealt strictly with theology almost. There was very few hortatory, that means exhortation type, or imperatives, commands, almost none. Almost none. And that's going to change dramatically in chapter 12. That's where Paul's going to say, now, here's how you live this out. Here's what we're looking for in terms of the Christian life and your basic experience in time, your lifestyle that you're going to have to adopt. And if you look ahead there into Romans 12, actually, it starts, and he says, I urge you. He uses the verb parakaleo, which means to urge or exhort, to encourage. I urge you, and then he switches to imperatives. It's an infinitive. But and it's interesting to see how Paul does this. He doesn't hardly use any imperatives, but he uses imperatival participles, he uses imperatival infinitives, and he uses other imperatival constructions. Sometimes a verb is elided that would be supplied, and the one you would supply would be an imperative. So he exhorts, he doesn't command, but yet he still commands, if you follow that. That's how Paul goes about this with the Romans. So first, you got to present your bodies a daily living sacrifice. You get up in the morning and your first question better be, all right, God, what do you want today? It shouldn't be, what's my plans? What's on my agenda? Let me check my calendar. It should be, God, what do you want today? And guide me and lead me in where I should be and what I should be doing. And you are alive. And obviously there's a moral quality to it because it's reference is holy. You're not just... And this is not a once-for-all thing, although that people make a big deal out of this. To present is a present infinitive, and they say you've got to keep doing this over and over again. You do, but that the infinitive doesn't prove that. That's, again, another way of taking the Greek and making it say what it really doesn't say. But you do have to do it over and over again, but you can't prove that from the text. And or if I remember, well, I'll take that back. I think it's an aorist infinitive. And I cannot find out, I don't think so. It's an aorist infinitive. It is an aorist infinitive, I can tell by the form. So they say, well, you just got to do this once for all. You just get up now today, let's all do it right now. All right, we're presenting our bodies here. Living sacrifices, holy sacrifices. And three adjectives actually qualify this. Living, holy, and acceptable. All qualify the word bodies. And so he starts off, and then he tells them, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then he goes into the local church and spiritual gifts and how you're supposed to function, that you've got a particular spiritual gift. Everybody's got one in this list. This list in Romans forms the list of permanent spiritual gifts. And for those of you, again, who have, most of you haven't heard it because I've only taught it once, I think. But we will be looking at the doctrine of spiritual gifts. And it is much more in-depth and thorough than anything you've ever seen. I can tell you that much because I've seen everybody else's, the ones that have them. And they're a hodgepodge and they're a little mixed up. Certain things, you know, have been a little mixed up sometimes. Well, we just, that, you know, you get the good deposit and then you iron out what the little wrinkles you find. That's really about all it is. And then he goes from there, and then he just gives a series of just, you know, it's almost, you might think it's arbitrary. I'm sure it wasn't in his mind. But he just starts firing off. Let love be without hypocrisy, verse 9. Abhor what's evil. Cling to what's good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another. Don't lag behind in diligence. Be fervent in spirit. Serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope. Persevering in tribulation. Devoted to prayer. Oh, all these things in the Christian life. Now all of a sudden the theology's gone. Now let's put where the rubber meets the road. How are we expected to live if we claim salvation and we claim to be a part of God's plan? Romans 12 and on is going to be devoted to all of that. How we interact with one another, what we do, and all those things. So again, this is the way you live. How are we to live? Well, we're going to get a big batch of what you're expected to do. So prepare to get your butt kicked. Because no doubt, everybody here is failing at some of these. Except for me, of course. But the rest of you, you know, you have problems. I know. No, we all fail at these. I mean, and again, I'm not going to get up here and tell you which ones I fail at. I get nailed in class sometimes too, but I'm not going to tell you when. You're just going to have to guess. And you shouldn't be sitting there guessing about where Ron's getting nailed, by the way, or some other believer. How does this apply to me? That's kind of what we're going to go for there. So again, it's used metaphorically here again to denote your course of life, the way you live, your conduct. The last adjective there, on ex ik naistos, not literally not tracked or not capable of being tracked, is derived from the verb ex ik niadzo, to search or track down, and then the alpha prefix negates it. It's untrackable. So if you were to see God's, as it were, his footprints in history, you couldn't follow. I mean, it's apart from God allowing you through revelation. But people, God's ways, again, are much higher than ours. So the 46, these final two statements make it very clear that mankind is incapable of penetrating everything that God does or why he does it. Mankind cannot comprehend the wisdom and knowledge of God that forms the basis for his conduct in the world. And we all have questions. I understand that when you first come to doctrine, you have a lot of questions. More than, because over the years, your questions gradually get answered. And so that's why we counsel people, okay, when you first start first, you're going to hear a lot of new things. You're going to be challenged by some things. You're not going to have everything answered all at once. God doesn't give everybody all the answers all at once. And part of the reason he doesn't do that is because, again, he's weeding people out. He wants to see who really wants to know him and who's just faking it. Who just says, well, I want to be a believer, but I don't really care about knowing God or applying his plan. I want to go to heaven. I just don't want any of the responsibilities of it. Well, how does that work on your job if you go at it like that? Oh, you'll be fired. And that idea that, well, I just want to go to heaven and God has no claims on me otherwise. Oh, that's just completely wrong. You've been bought with a price. You don't even own your rights to your own life anymore if you're a believer. You gave those up. When you believe. Isaiah chapter 55 is our verse here. But the only way you can ever know these things again about God is if he reveals them. If he doesn't reveal them, he can let us know what he's doing and why. And that's what prophecy is. Prophecy tells us where we're headed. And in some cases, it tells us why we're headed there. We're not all there yet. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts. Nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. And my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. And he says, I am certain of fulfilling every good pleasure in my word that I intend to fulfill. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout, and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so will my word be which goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire, and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. And so his plan is bigger than what we can see, obviously. We have to content ourselves with the fact that we are limited in our ability to perceive in the first place, and in what all has been revealed. And the knowledge and some of these things, God's ways, are we don't always get them. But see, this is where faith comes in. Again, that was one of the things that really stood out to me in the book of Ecclesiastes. That book argues as much for living by faith as any book in the Bible, I think. Because it argues that we can't see all these things. We don't always understand. There's a time for everything. There is a season. But what is the season? When is it right? When is it time to look? When is it time to give up looking? When is it time to kill and a time to heal? When is it a time to love and a time to hate? When is it, you know, how do we know? And the fact is, we have to live by faith. And he asks hard theological questions. Who knows that the spirit of a man goes up and the dog and all that? Well, he just dies and goes back to the earth. Well, who can know that? The only way you can know that's through revelation. That animals are different than humans. That animals don't have souls. So God's ways, we don't always understand them, we don't always get them. But what we can get is, number one, is God for us? I mean, we wrapped up chapter 8. Do you remember the end of chapter 8? Not if you remember chapter 8. Is God for us? Yeah, absolutely. In every way. You look in Romans 8, this is where Paul concluded, before we went on sort of our digression here about the nature of Israel and their place and all this. Verse 28, we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God. And the good in this context, again, refers to conformity to the image of Christ. Now, how is he going to do that in our individual lives? Well, like with anything, using an analogy of, let's say, a potter or a sculptor, particularly a sculptor, he starts with a particular block of whatever, wood, marble, whatever, and then he whacks it, and he hits it, and he chops it, and he cuts it. And from the standpoint of the material, the wood, if you could interview wood, you say, that's not fun for you, is it? No, having this chainsaw on you, it's not fun. And so, but at the end, when you see the great creation that this guy comes up with, say, you know, Michelangelo's David, these types of things, statues, art that's recognized as a great historic art. God does the same thing with people. And some of us, I hate to say it, are rougher to start with than the others. Some of us are more headstrong. And you know who you are. Some of us are far more headstrong. And when God has to, you know, and it's like with the horse and the bit and all that. If the horse just does what the rider wants, the bit doesn't bother him that much. It's when he won't. And so God's more than happy to put the bit in your mouth and yank when he needs to. And he does all this. And we don't always know why. And again, it's not always pleasant even. But we do know that at the end, well, first, he's going to conform us to the image of his son. But that might require a lot of work in some of our cases. Well, all of us. All of us, it requires a lot of work. Verse 33, who will bring a charge against God's elect? Or verse 31, what shall we say to these things? How do we respond to all this? If God is for us, who is against us? I mean, effectively. Can anybody effectively throttle God's plan or derail God's plan for your life? You are the only one that can do that. Other people can't. You say, well, they treat me mean, I've been abused and this and that, and I can't function. Oh, you can get over it. You can learn to forgive and forget and move on. That's a huge part of this. We saw that even in the doctrine of mercy. Part of showing mercy is forgiving and forgetting and moving on. That's, even if a person deserves to be jammed, you don't necessarily get your pound of flesh. That's not what we have to do. So if God's for us, who will be against us? Who will bring a charge, verse 33, against God's elect? Who is the one who condemns? And the question to all of these is, nobody can effectively do this. Not to say that people won't try, but they can't effectively do it. Verse 35, who will separate us from the love of Christ? And then he asks all these questions. Tribulation, that's anything that brings pressure into your life. Distress, persecution, that's obviously for the faith, for the truth. Famine, nakedness, peril, or sword. Sword can encompass a lot of things. Conflicts of any kind, from simple ones to armed conflicts. Any of those things. But we have to adopt the attitude that he's got here, just as it is written. For your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered a sheep to be slaughtered. But, as he says, in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. And nothing, he says, can separate us from the love of God. So we don't have to go around guessing, oh, is God for me? Is he mad at me today? God's no more for you again on your best day that you ever have than he is on your worst day. God, in that regard, does not change his attitude towards us. He's for you or you'd be consumed. The only reason we're alive by God's grace. It's good pleasure. Every day. And anybody can get up and say, well, I'm a good Christian. That's why he keeps me alive. And that's not it. That's not it. He has purposes beyond what you and I see. Now, I'm not arguing against being a good Christian, by the way. You probably should try to do that. Shoot for that. But, again, his ways are beyond all of us. But we can certainly know, even in the midst of all the things that happen,
okay, God didn't bring me out. You know, the like, you know, he didn't bring us out here to kill us. That's what Moses kept telling them. God hasn't brought us out here to kill us. But they kept, oh no, no water, no food, no this, no that. You know, God has brought us out here to kill us. You brought us out here to kill us yourself. You know. And you know, every time he heard that, Moses had to cringe a little bit, knowing he'd committed murder in his life early already. That had to sting a little bit when they say that to him. Well, 47 here, both statements together express the impossibility of a person fully grasping the intricate complexities of God's plan. The first describes something that cannot be found by searching for it, no matter how hard you search, while the second denotes footprints that are impossible to track. And 48, while it is true that people can recognize what is going on at a particular time in history by observing events as they unfold. Now, what are we seeing today in history? We're seeing, once again, the illusion of choice given to the American people in the election. And what are our great choices? Well, it's not so much. Not great choices this year. But guess what? Both of them will say the same things. The other one can't be trusted. And, I can do the job better. That's essentially the gist of their whole deal. I can do the job better, and she can't be trusted, or he can't be trusted. Anybody that trusts the Clintons, go do some research on the Clintons. Find out how many dead bodies are in their past. People that mysteriously disappeared or died under strange circumstances. This is a political dynasty, and they will kill people that get in their way. Now, there's no doubt that, you know, most people are shocked by what they see in these politicians. They should be. I mean, if you really knew the truth of some of this, we'd probably leave the country. But still, I have to ask, in the big scheme of things, is any country really way ahead of us? Where do you want to go? Haiti? I don't think so. Where else do you want to live? I'll take my chances here. Even though I know our country's on its way down. But again, we have certain things and all of that. You want to go 90% taxation in Canada? You want that? You know? But you get free health care. But, of course, you get only 10% of your income, too. They give you the tithe. So, again, people can recognize something as it unfolds, but it's equally evident that merely observing the events of history does not guarantee one an understanding of God's purposes, decisions, and actions. And 49, however, when properly understood, history bears the imprint of God's knowledge, His wisdom, His decisions, and His conduct. And people can see this if they know how to read history. And God obviously blessed certain things in history, and He jammed certain things in history. That's God's choice. He's sovereign. All right, well, our last verse is here. For who has known the mind of the Lord? Any hands and takers? No? None of us were there at the beginning to consult. He couldn't consult with anybody. He didn't have anybody to consult with, for one thing. Only the Father, the Son, and the Spirit were there. Or who became His counselor? For explanatory use of the conjunction gar, G-A-R, who, here, interrogative, tis. What's going on here? Tis, interrogative, who, here, has known, recognized, or figured out. Gnosko, G-I-N-O-S-K-O. That was weird. Okay, well, we'll see what's going on now. I'm having all kinds of trouble here today. Who has known or figured out? Again, a constantive aorist is just ask the question. It doesn't mean at any particular time or whenever. It's just, has anybody ever done this? The nous, N-O-U-S, the mind, the thinking, the intellect of the Lord. Again, a subjective genitive here of kurios. Again, kurios is a title for deity. God, as a subjective genitive, God's thinking is in view. He does the thinking. Who has figured out God's thinking, essentially? And that's a way you could translate this. Who has ever figured out the thinking of God? And the answer is nobody. These are questions that, of course, demand nobody answers. Or the disjunctive use of the conjunction A, just looks like an E in the Greek. Or who, interrogative again, adjective tis. Who has become, ginomai is our verb, G-I-N-O-M-A-I, to enter into a different state. This implies change. Who has ever grown to the point that they could become His counselor? Who has become His counselor? Counselor is the word sumbalas.
S-U-M-B-O-L-O-S. B-O-U-L-O-S. I'm sorry. Boulos, Sumboulos. One time, this is used only here, one who offers opinions or advice. An advisor, a counselor. Who has ever offered the Lord advice? I mean, effectively. Nobody. Nobody has ever offered the Lord advice effectively. Now, people have lots of advice for him. That doesn't mean people aren't stupid and think they can. Of him, again, objective, genitive, who has counseled God? This is God is receiving the action of the counseling in this objective genitive. That's how it functions. It functions as the object of the verb here, or actually the verbal noun, counselor. Or, verse 35, who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? Again, another disjunctive use, alternative here, or conjunction A, who, interrogative adjective tis, has first given is prodidomi. And this means exactly that. It's a compound, D-I-D-O-M-I. So this part means to give, and pro means before or ahead of time. One time, again, this word, Paul uses a number of hapaxis through here. Those are words, means only spoken once in the Greek. Literally, to give before, to pay in advance. To give something to somebody first. Who has first given to him? The object here is not specified what they would give to him, but the indirect object is, that's God. Altos here, the dative, is the indirect object. Who has first given to God? So that, and actually what you have here is a conjunction chi that they've translated almost as a result clause. And that's sort of the idea of what's going on here. To give it to him first, then God owes you. See, this brings up the question, does God ever owe anybody? No. God never owes anybody anything. The only thing God has to do is conduct himself in consistency with his own essence. And again, he doesn't owe Moses mercy any more than he owed Pharaoh mercy. He doesn't owe us anything. But because he bound himself by his word and all of that, now we have great promises from God. Now this brings up other issues. Why does God promise us things if he doesn't have to? Because he wants us to be assured of these things. He wants us to know for a certainty because, as he says in there in Hebrews, God, who cannot lie, it's impossible for God to lie. He said two things are impossible. And the first one is it's impossible for God to lie. He states it very strongly in the Greek. He doesn't say he can't do it. He just says it's absolutely impossible. He cannot ever tell an untruth. So if anything you find in God's Word, you can guarantee you it's true. Even if you don't understand it, even if there's questions about it, you can take it to the bank that it's true. So who has first given to him, so that, then you have a triple compound here, ant apodidomi, A-N-T-A-P-O-D-I-D-O-M-I. Again, to give, away from, and then anti means back again, or in a reciprocal way. To practice reciprocity, this word's used seven times, this particular verb. Future passive indicative here. All the others have been aorist, but this one is so that it will be paid back to him. It's a future. And it asks a question, a real question. Does God, will God ever owe anybody? Mm-mm, never will. To him, again, the dative here, to pay back to him, the dative of indirect object. Because from him, and through him, and to him are all things. Why does God not concern himself with ever owing anybody? Number one, he created everything. What would God need that he doesn't have? And not just in terms of physical things, but certainly in terms of advice. What advice does God really need? If he is who we believe he is in his essence, he's sovereign, righteous, just, eternally alive, loving, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, cannot change, immutable, and is absolute truth, cannot lie. If he's all these things, what would he need? You would be hard-pressed, I think, to come up with anything God might need. And he even asked that question in a rhetorical way. I believe it's in one of the Psalms. He said, what do you think you can give me? I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. I own it all. It's all mine. I created it. And by virtue of creation, that's one of the fundamental rights in any good society, is the right of ownership. If it's yours, it's yours. And you can do with it what you want.
You know, within reason. Obviously, you can't violate laws and all of that, and some of the laws are goofy. But still, the fact is, the fundamental right of ownership. If God created it all, it's His. Now, same thing here with this world. It's God's world, but who's running it now? The God of this world, Satan. Small g, O-D. Not big g, O-D. Satan runs it. He's a squatter. He moved in when Adam forfeited his right to authority over this planet. God wanted Adam to administrate this world for him. That's always been God's goal. Mankind is to administrate God's plan here on planet Earth under the Lord in righteousness. But when Adam forfeited all that, Satan tells Jesus when he tempts him. He said, all this has been handed over to me. He didn't say who handed it over, but it has been handed over. So he is the God of this world. And he runs it according to his own warped standards and his own depraved mind. And the world out here buys into it. They buy into the cosmic darkness. Because why? Well, number one, they don't like the light. The light is troubling to people. They don't want to hear the truth. And the truth of God, part of that matter of the divine viewpoint is the light is illuminating because it's true. It's real. It's accurate. And so everybody should know that, yeah, Satan is a squatter. But God's going to get rid of him eventually. And all those events that it takes to get rid of him are recorded in chapter 6 through 19 of the book of Revelation. And it isn't pretty. He does not go without a fight. Matter of fact, he doesn't even give up his access to heaven without a fight. Finally, one day, God looks at Michael and goes, go get him. And Michael's ready. I think Michael's got issues with Satan. But I think all of us have issues with Satan, really. We should. This guy is no good. You know, they wrote that song about him, you're no good. And he continues to be no good. And he's not ever going to change. He's incorrigible. And so the God of this world runs this thing. But guess whose it belongs to? From him? It's because God created it. Because here you got a causal use of the conjunction hoti, H-O-T-I. Because from him, preposition ek with the ablative of source, of autos, from him. From the source of him. He created all things from the source of his own essence. He didn't need to consult anybody. He had everything he needed. From him and chi, through him. Preposition dia. You have three prepositions here. All followed by the autos, the pronoun. Through him. Now dia with the genitive here denotes the intermediate agent. How did everything, the all things here, and when we don't get that until coming up, but he's got the definite article, to pos. Pos means all, each, or everything. With the article, it means the totality of everything. It's a way, a stronger way of saying it in the Greek. The everything. Because through him are all things. In other words, everything you see in this world, this all came through God. In fact, it came through God the Son. He's the agent that did it. The Father planned it, the Son executed it. So everything that's created, trees, sky, land, air, all the elements on the atomic table, a periodic table, all of that, the building blocks of life, everything God, Jesus Christ created. And God the Son, obviously the humanity of Jesus didn't create it because he wasn't there. And this is obviously pre-incarnation. This is actually pre-creation. But here all things come through him. He's the agent that brings all things into existence. And to him are all things. Literally into him as a conclusion. You got eis, the directional preposition, again without toss, but this indicates effective penetration. In other words, to him, everything is going to find its ultimate resolution in God. All things will be resolved by God and in God and through God. Mankind thinks he's resolving things. Mankind thinks he's running this world. Mankind is deluded. Mankind is functioning under the prince of darkness, who himself is deluded with his corrupt wisdom, as it's called. It's corrupt, though. It's not wisdom. It's not real wisdom. He talks about that kind of wisdom, earthly, natural, demonic. That's the wisdom of Satan. And God's going to overturn that wisdom. He's going to show the world that, you know what, my way works, Satan's didn't. And evil never wins out over good in the long term. Now, in the time when we're here, of course, we see evil winning all the time. You just don't know. But this is where our faith comes in. Well, has God abandoned us? Is he going to fulfill his plan? It may look bad for us right now. And those people, say in Daniel's 70th week, those Jews that run out of, they're commanded to flee Jerusalem when they see this happen. When the Antichrist takes a seat in the temple and declares himself to be God in the flesh. When they see this, they're supposed to run. Well, the best guess we have is that they run out east there to Jordan. That they go across the Jordan River and run out east to Petra. Because there's a place in there where you can't get machinery in and out of. And if you've ever seen it, it's quite spectacular. The Edomites who lived over there, they built some amazing things into these rocks. Astonishing stuff. But ultimately, when they get over there, they're going to be surrounded. They're going to be in there. And it's all going to be closing in on them. They're going to be crying out to God. And he will answer. But it's going to look very dark. It's going to look very bleak for them. Anybody who gets saved in Daniel's 70th week, it's going to look bleak for them too, because Antichrist is going to enforce, again, a worldwide monetary system, something that was not possible until the advent of computer technology. And all the things that we have now, RFIDs and all these other things, and so you can track and monitor everything. You know exactly where everything is. And then, add to that, the invasion of your privacy at every place on this planet. I'm surprised we don't have 5 cameras in here. You can't go anywhere. You can't go anywhere, say, in Ybor City without being seen on a camera somewhere. You can't hide in there. I mean, not that I'd go to Ybor City and hide, but I'm just saying. It's my point is that your privacy is constantly violated. They've got cameras on the light post so they can track accidents. They got red light cameras, which are illegal, but we won't go into that today. Don't get me started on that one. So, but this is all making us safe, right? Don't you feel safer? I don't. I don't feel one bit safer. With all this technology and all the monitoring of everything in the world, and plus, the NSA and CIA and the other groups that are monitoring every one of your phone calls, every one of your texts. You think you got privacy? You don't have privacy. You just think you do. It's an illusion. So this is why, as believers, we have, we want to walk the straight and narrow for several reasons. Number one, not the least of which, is you're being watched. But in the angelic conflict, we're being watched anyway. So because from him here, and through him, and into him, he is going to be the final resolution of all things, the all things, the totality of things. To him be the glory forever. And to him, dative of altas, the glory is doxa. Again, first this word meant to have an opinion, then it came to mean a favorable opinion. That one looks up, say, to someone, and then treats them properly by glorifying him. Here, say, in the case of God. So, to him and through him are all things. To him be the glory into the ages. Directional preposition eis, and then this, you got ho ion, which indicates that in God's plan, time, we might say, will be immeasurable. The infinity with respect to time is eternity. But apparently these are measured out in ages, like in Tolkien's books. They had different ages, and sometimes you see this in other things too. They had different ages where certain things, certain principles and all, and certain groups ruled in this. Well, there are going to be these ages throughout eternity. For some time after I got saved, I thought, well, there'll be no markers for time in eternity, but there will be. The time we will still be at least, I think, at some level conscious of it. That we'll know this is going on forever and ever. Because of those trees there that bear fruit once every month and the fruit changes. So you'll know a month has gone by when the new fruit pops up. And that's got to be quite some trees, of course, that bear a different kind of fruit every month. That's something we don't have. So, again, the time will still in some ways be a factor, but I don't think, we're not going to be conscious of it like we are now, probably. You'll live in the eternal now with the eternal God, and he will dwell among his people and all of that. Okay, well, we've only got about 5 minutes. We got through that. That's about where I planned to today, so we'll just stop there. And we'll finish up this chapter on Tuesday, I suspect. Yeah, it looks like it. So I did send out the notes for chapter 12, at least the first 20 pages. So you should probably have those maybe by Wednesday. And then there's a doctrine that we will do after verse 1 of chapter 12. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this time together. We thank you for the privilege it is to study your word, to understand your plan, and pray as we continue to pursue these things that you will continue to bless our thinking in all ways. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.